Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Dodd Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II based podcast. And despite all the craziness going on in the world, I'm sure everybody who listens to this podcast is up to date with what's going on around the world. And so we're not even going to try to compete with all the other outlets out there. So instead, for the next hour and a half, hour or so, let's take our mind off of current situations going on in the military world, and let's go back 80 years and just kind of relax a little bit, and let's talk about what we're all here to listen to, and that's World War II-based content. And joining us, as always, is Henry Sledge, and we have a guest tonight. I will allow Henry to introduce him, but Henry, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing okay. Not functioning on as much sleep as I would have normally had. I had to get my son to football practice really early this morning, but I'm doing good.
Football practice already?
It's spring training.
Prior to school?
Yeah. I had to get him there at 0600 this morning.
Wow. So.
And his first mountain bike race over the weekend. So, you know.
I saw that. That's fantastic. We'll have to get into that a little bit later. I don't want to leave our guest hanging out in the wings too long. So go ahead and introduce our guest, and we'll get going.
Okay. Well, we've got a great guest tonight on What's a Scuttlebutt podcast, folks. His name is Dave Holland. He is originally from the United States, but has resided in Australia for the past 28 years. Dave served 8 years in the United States Marine Corps in infantry. From 2009 to 2013, he visited Guadalcanal a number of times, and from 2018 to 2020, he lived there full-time. He is a Guadalcanal battlefield guide and a member of several Solomon Islands battle conservation groups. Dave has assisted a number of authors and researchers with Guadalcanal material, and Dave Holland is currently working on a book featuring his time walking and researching the Guadalcanal battlefields. He also runs the YouTube and Facebook sites titled Guadalcanal Walking a Battlefield. So my buddy, my fellow Alabamian, Dave Holland, how are you tonight?
Yeah, not too bad. In Australia, it's in the afternoon. And I know why they in Alabama, being from Alabama, I fully understand why they do football practice, you know, preschool. Very serious.
Yeah.
I try to tell people that here and they go, what do you mean? Yeah. Mm. But I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on, you and Don both.
Well, I imagine getting the kids used to starting football practice so early is probably advantageous in the summertime when the heat's extraordinary and the humidity's through the roof. So it probably is best to get them used to that early morning run, and the parents too.
Yeah, they go 2 days. I remember them in Alabama in the heat in August. Go 2 days in the morning and the afternoon. Yes.
Well, Dave had a really good show on World War II TV. He's been on twice, and I really enjoyed the Chesty Puller show a few days ago. So, and that, Don, you know, it's prophetic that what last week with Preston Stewart, we were talking about Chesty, and I was thinking about that. I'm like, man, too bad Dave couldn't be a part of this conversation.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, what we were talking about, what I was reading from the Peleliu Tragic Triumph book and some of the opinions they were posting in there about Chesty Puller and how I kind of made the comparison to some of the ways that people felt that Patton tend to have a little bit of a glory hound role, and kind of how in the PTO, at least, that Chesty Puller filled that position for, at least as the media was concerned, they wanted that news hound kind of headline guy, and he filled that role pretty well, at least according to some of the opinions in that book.
Mm-hmm.
So, Dave, just one of the things we like to do when we first have people on the show, obviously, Henry just gave us the rundown, but if you want to just give us a little bit of background, maybe skip ahead to what got you to make that move to the Guadalcanal area and the Solomon Islands, and how you got so heavily invested in the history of Guadalcanal?
Oh, yeah, that's probably a good question. I work for the Australian government, so being in Australia, they obviously have an interest in the South Pacific, and in Guadalcanal and the Solomon Islands in general. So I had the opportunity to travel there on a number of times through work, which is great. You know, didn't come out of my pocket, so to speak.
Those are the best trips.
Best trips, yes. Being a former Marine and being a military history nut, you know, I was in my element on Guadalcanal, and I thought, well, you know, my short trips there, I used to do as much out of work time as I could, exploring the battlefield and taking people on battlefields and giving battlefield studies and things like that. I mean, even when the Australian Army was over there, I used to give these called battlefield studies, and we used to have the NCOs and officers, we'd run them through terrain appreciations and analysis, and, you know, what would they do in their if they had the same situation. So I'd run a few of them. And then in 2018, I got a full 2-year deployment to the Solomon Islands. So I was going to take my time there, and I thought, well, I'll really, really drill down on the things that it needed to be drilled down on. I mean, because a lot of people who they go to Guadalcanal, they'll go for a week-long tour in the tour groups, and they hit the main areas like Bloody Ridge, and, you know, they go to Tulagi and Alligator Creek, but they miss some of the off-the-tour spots. They're very, very important in the campaign. So it allowed me time to really drill down in those spots that people don't get to visit. And in all my free time I was over there, I spent, and even during my work time, I got to spend a bit of time doing it because my commanders and my bosses over there was pretty good. I mean, every time we have VIPs or would come through in through the Australian government and even in the U.S. government, I was the man who would take them around. So I was doing that in my work time too. So it was almost like my government job was my secondary employment.
Would these people you were taking around, Dave, did they like have a pretty good basis of knowledge of the campaign, and they gave you a list of places they wanted to see, or were they just handed over to you and you were told, hey, show these people the iconic sites of Guadalcanal? How did that usually play out?
The VIP trips, yes. It would generally, you know, I don't know if you've done a VIP trip. It's like, we've got some spare time. This person's a government official or say U.S. officer that may have a general interest in Guadalcanal. And generally, I didn't say too many or drill down deep and want to know the full details. I did take the Australian Prime Minister and his wife around, and they had a good interest in it, even though there's no Australians at Guadalcanal. You know, they asked the right pertinent questions.
Well, it was hugely relevant for them, you know.
Oh, yes. At the same time, you know, they were fighting. You know, Guadalcanal and the Americans had the right hand and the left hand at the same time. The Americans and the Australians were on Kokoda and Papua New Guinea. So they were heavily involved in Papua New Guinea. I took a lot of people around on tours there, and I did have some, I would consider hardcore tourists. Mm-hmm. People would actually would travel over there just for to spend the time and delved in a lot of information. I had a big background on Guadalcanal. So, but when you have big groups, you know, you cater to all types. You have some that have a general interest, and some have a real deep, keen interest. So when you take a group out, the first thing you do is just make an assessment of, cater to your audience and see who you're dealing with, and then go from there.
All right.
When it comes to some of those spots you were talking about earlier about, you know, everybody goes to the normal areas that we've all read about, but you want to try to fill in the voids, if you will, and some of those combat, some of those engagements and areas that people know less about. If you had to think of a handful of those, which one do you, I don't want to say enjoy, it's, using the word enjoy when it comes to talking about combat, it's a little rough, but out of those spots that you feel don't get enough notice and spotlight shine on them, which one do you enjoy the most taking people to, and that you would want to share with our audience to kind of get people to realize, you know, it's this particular location is just as important as all the rest of them?
Yes, I mean, there's a number of them, but one in particular is a place called Coffin Corner. Now, Coffin Corner was involved from the 24th to the 27th of October. It was considered part of the Battle over Henderson Field. And Coffin Corner was probably the most concentrated site of three main Japanese assaults throughout the campaign. It was the largest Japanese assault site. And a lot of people don't even know about Coffin Corner. I mean, they know, like, John Bassalone was involved in that, probably of, I'd say, 600 or 700 yards away. But the rest of his battalion in the U.S. Army, the 164th Regiment, you know, they became very instrumental in stopping the Japanese. And I'd go as far as to say Coffin Corner was the last Japanese offensive attack in the Pacific theater in World War II. I mean, you had some bonsai attacks later, obviously, in other campaigns, but they were bonsai attacks when the concentrated offensive attacks. The Japanese on Guadalcanal was on the offensive. And they wasn't on the defensive. It was only until the January battles in the U.S. Army involving Mount Austin, where we know as the Thin Red Line in the movies and books, they became on the defensive. But they were only just standing by to the rest of the guys could come over and go on offensive again. So to answer the original question, Coffin Corner. And it's the only place on Guadalcanal that I've been that it kind of makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. I mean, because the Japanese were pushing into a small track called the Jeep Trail there, and they concentrated their attacks because it was the only trail that would go through the jungle, and it would link up to a place called Fighter Airstrip Number 1. So there was an auxiliary field for Henderson Field. So they concentrated their attacks at the corner of the jungle in Coffin Corner, and they had a Marine who basically said, if he was a coffin maker, he'd be a millionaire.
Wow.
Because the bodies were just honestly stacked up in rows. And that was the Marines and the Army. That was where their unit, I guess, designation was. So you had 7th Marines on one side, and you had the 164th on the other. Mm-hmm. And normally it's a good delineation lines between units and, you know, on landmarks such as a creek or a road or a track. And that track was a delineation line between the 7th Marines and the 164th, but it was an avenue of approach that the Japanese needed to go through, and they just concentrated in columns straight into that that road. And the Marines had 2 37 millimeter guns and a number of 50 cal and 30 caliber machine guns and a whole lot of BARs, all concentrated in that one spot,
which is a natural bottleneck. And that so they were, once you disable that first one in the column, and as they tend to try to do, the one in the back of the column, then everybody's kind of stuck, and it's just take them as you can. Where geographically is Coffin Corner on Guadalcanal? Is it near Alligator Creek, Tenere River, some of those areas?
Yeah, so if you go down Alligator Creek or Elu River, and it's basically, I'd say, 400 meters at the end of Elu River or Alligator Creek, so it's facing toward the south. And then it takes a L shape and it goes straight onto Bloody Ridge. So if you go between Bloody Ridge and if you go probably due east from Bloody Ridge, about, I'd say, 1,800 yards, you'll hit Coffin Corner.
Wow.
And then at Coffin Corner, then it made an L shape. So it's the corner that's the L shape. So it's the corner of the jungle. That's why they call it the corner.
Sure.
So the jungle and the lines actually turned into an L shape.
As you explore when you explored those areas, Dave, did you, because I know in one of your videos, it may have been the one on Edson's Ridge, where it's like you're in somebody's backyard. You know, you see villagers with their kids moving around. Did you ever have to go, hey, I'm investigating this aspect of the battle. Can I walk through your property? Was that ever an issue, or does everybody just kind of leave people alone? They know they're exploring, or?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's like anything. You get to know the people there. And Bloody Ridge is actually, it's called the Bloody Ridge Peace Park. It's only a national park in the Solomon Island. And you had a number of people over the years, like John Innes, which was an Australian expat that lived there, great battlefield historian. Unfortunately, he's passed away. He was instrumental in making it a peace park. So you have squatters who actually live there. So they're not even supposed to be there. They're supposed to be moving off the land, but the government's taking their time. So, you know, they really don't bother you. I mean, I've used to walk through and say hello. And the good things about the Solomon Islands, the Melanesian culture, a smile will get you everywhere. A smile and be friendly. It's just like, you know, sorry, humans anywhere. But those guys are really, really super friendly. They don't have any taboos against filming around them or on, you know, themselves. They'd love to be. They're very photogenic. They love to be photographed. So I didn't have any dramas. Doing that free reign, so to speak.
Did you see a lot of because I know when I was on Peleliu, you know, the Detritus of War is everywhere. I know in some of your videos I've seen you point out like a ration can or a fragment of a grenade or something. I mean, is that kind of thing just everywhere around Guadalcanal still to this day?
To this day, yes. It's getting less and less. Is once the locals start working out, they call it the white fella goes crazy over rust. They said all white fellas love rust.
That's fantastic. You know, they'll
still sell a white fella any rust.
That's you need to put that on a shirt but, for your tour.
But the first time I went there in 2009, I mean, for example, on Bloody Ridge, it was the locals, they set fires. They burned the grassland to build the little, gardens, cassava gardens and things. So mm-hmm. when every time they burn it, it used to be all this stuff on top of the ground. I mean, not even under the ground, I'm talking about on top of the ground. And you can imagine there's a lot of unexploded ordnance there.
Oh boy.
And it's a bit of a problem, a real problem, especially last year, was a number of Solomon Islands and actually two, there's a British and an Australian who died there from unexploded ordnance just last year alone. There's a number of injuries that happened. Yeah, that's the thing about the tourists who come in and, you know, they'll run up and they'll say, look, you know, here's some relics. And, you know, I can see why they do it. It's a third world country. But what that does is, especially the young kids, they go out and they'll dig up these relics and they'll dig up this unexploded ordnance and put themselves at danger just to sell it to the tourist, you know, who wants some of this stuff. And I can see why they would do it. And I've had a number of them run up to me before and go, hey, look at this.
And,
look at this egg. They call it an egg. That's a Japanese hand grenade. No, that's a Japanese knee mortar, and that's American frag. So yeah, I think we need to put it down and don't do that anymore.
Well,
but there's stuff everywhere. That's the stuff on top of the ground. There's heaps of stuff underneath the ground.
Well, I'm glad the conversation.
You can imagine.
I'm glad the conversation went this way because I was going to bring up before Henry did. On an unrelated note, I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos of cats who are out hunting out in the western of the United States. And when Henry and I were growing up, one of the things, and I'm sure you're familiar with this too, is young kids used to collect arrowheads from Native Americans. They'd be out in the woods and they'd find arrowheads. Well, it's gotten to the point now where arrowheads are getting harder and harder to find. The rule of thumb, at least amongst people who appreciate it, is you pick up the arrowhead, you inspect it, you take it for what it's worth, and you put it back in order to preserve that history, because if everybody takes it, there's not going to be anything left for people to see in the future. And I was kind of wondering, has the Solomon Islands kind of gotten to that point now where people, especially with what you do, people come down, they see something, they want to pick it up, and they kind of want to take it so as a souvenir, but you're kind of like, why don't you leave it here for the next group to come in so they can see it and appreciate the history for what it is? Or is there just so much stuff out there we haven't gotten to that point, it's just take it, it's just all over the place?
Yes. Yeah, every time you get the tourists there, they'll see something on the ground. We say, especially on the Bloody Ridge Peace Park or the Bloody Ridge National Park, don't pick up anything. One, they shouldn't be picking up anything if you don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. It'll blow your hand off or get injured. Or, yeah, but they see just everyone wants, you know, especially these hardcore tourists, you want a bit of a relic from Guadalcanal, you know, piece of shrapnel or a spoon or a webbing buckle. Let's just pick it and put it in our pocket and, you know, they had a tendency at one stage, the National Museum, because some of the stuff was going to the National Museum, but obviously being a third world country, you know, depending on who you knew there, if you went there and you asked for relics, they would sell it to you. So that, you know, that didn't get too well on that. But I know you got to remember Guadalcanal, after the campaign was over in February 43, it became a major logistical and training base.
Sure.
So you've got these camps that hold divisions. Like the Terry had the whole 3rd Marine Division. The 6th U.S. Marine Division was born on Guadalcanal in 1944. So you got still all those camps there. And you have thousands and thousands of U.S. Army, Navy, and Marines training on Guadalcanal. I read somewhere, I don't know if we can even verify it, but over 1 million Americans passed through Guadalcanal during the war.
Wow.
It's a major, major base. In fact, before the war, the capital of the British Solomon Islands was Tulagi. They had like a little colonial seat over there, and there was random villages through the on the coast of at Guadalcanal Island. America built a medium-sized U.S. city basically on Guadalcanal, and then when the Americans left, the British came back in and says, oh, we're not going to Tulagi, we'll go to Guadalcanal. You built us a city. So that city today is called Haniara, which is the capital city. It was made, Americans built that from scratch. The road network is still there. They want the Americans to come back in and build the roads back because, you know, I don't think the potholes have been fixed since 1945.
I know researching, you know, reading through my dad's manuscript, like we've talked about, I've been struck at how much time he spent on Guadalcanal. And it's made me, because I've always read about the iconic parts, you know, Robert Leckie and Edson and all those, and Chesty Pillar and all those things. But, you know, yeah, man, I mean, 1st Marine Division was training there. They would go on maneuvers there coming down from Pavuvu, which is, Pavuvu is what, 60 miles up the slot from Guadalcanal?
I think it's 30. It's in the Russell Islands. Probably from the western part of Guadalcanal. As you go up the slot, I'd say it's maybe 30 or 40 miles. It might be 60 miles. I have to double check it from there. It's not that far at all. It's probably 60 miles. You're right, Henry.
Yeah.
So I always wanted to get there. I flew over it a couple of times. I really would try to get out there to the old Pavuvu camps. And I've spoke to some people who's been there, the locals. And, you know, the camp's not there, but you can still see a lot of the remnants of the Pavuvu training camp. Not the airfield still there and a few other things.
Going back to what Henry said about his father and all the, you know, times he spent training there. When you read like the Robert Leckie's and the Guadalcanal diaries and, you know, the firsthand accounts from the guys who fought on the island, then went on other campaigns and then circulated back for their training exercises. That's one of the things that they always had a hard time. They're like, wow, this does not look like the Guadalcanal we remembered when we landed here, because so much logistics and infrastructure was put in for the training facility that, from what I understand, it just looked completely different. And so it's like, oh, wait, this is the same place? And because that's how much it changed and how much infrastructure is put in there.
So I read a good story one time by a veteran, a Marine veteran from the 1st Marine Division, who was the first group that went in. And he was at a reunion years later, and this one guy was in the room talking about, oh, Guadalcanal, you know, when I was there, you know, the mules. And he goes, mules? what mules were Guadalcanal? So the Guadalcanal is in three phases. Three veterans, they consider themselves three phases of Guadalcanal. So you had the 1st Marine Division in the first, say, 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the U.S. Army in the 2nd Marine Division that came in after that, who was in the land campaign. And then after that, basically, you had the guys who would go there, and either guys in the air campaign, it was running air missions out of there, or the training and logistics. So this one veteran said to this guy, was talking about the mules. He said, I never seen any mules on Guadalcanal. If you had seen any mules on Guadalcanal, we would have ate them in the first few months there. But he'd bring mules. The Army did bring mules in January to try to negotiate some of that terrain.
Yeah, it's almost like if you didn't come to Guadalcanal in the George S. Elliott, it's not the same experience.
Oh yes. And even the guys to this day, you still got veterans. You know, I was on the main, they call it the MSR, you know, main resistance line, or the front line, and you guys behind the rear. And mm-hmm. you know, even the guys that was there from the 7th of August, and even the mortarmen used to say, oh, you're the support guys. Or I mean, the riflemen would tell the mortarmen, you're the support guys, or the machine gunners, you're the support guys, because you're about three steps behind me. So you're always going to have that animosity. Yeah, not animosity, but I guess it's friendly banter.
You know, I was thinking, you're talking about how we were talking about after it was captured and throughout the war, Guadalcanal is being used for staging and training. I lived out here in Fort Myers, Florida, and we have a place called Page Field, and it was actually a Marine Corps base during World War II. And a buddy of mine's family, they've been down here for the long term. They used to be cattle ranchers, and they have access to a little bit of land. Most of it's been sold out for development, but they got this cattle pasture that's in the general vicinity of where the gun ranges were when the Marines were down here. And over my display case, we'd go out there shooting and fishing. Over my display case, I got like 30 cal rounds that just lost velocity from the target range. They never hit anything. They just lost velocity, and they're in their full